Chatter on books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. We've got a really good show this evening. I'm a little concerned, and our author is Laura Scalzo, who is from the DMV, from the district, which we love. The book is American Arcadia. Laura and this book have come to us by way of Scott Price, great author of Playing Through the Whistle, one of the best books ever. And it's a really good book, and it's really interesting. And it was intimidating to me because this is one of those books, Jamie, David, and our intern Lily, where real people who really understand literature and understand, you know, allegories and these kinds of things would really be able to speak to the brilliance of this book. I are not one of those people, but I really liked it. So looking forward to that. I just kept reading reviews of it going, oh my God, this is so over my head. Okay, but first, our lineup for this evening. We got Claude doing all the important work. We have David Aldridge, just fresh from breaking very important DMV news. Jamie McIntyre, about to break important news about Ukraine, I think. And introducing Lily Martin, our intern, which means Chatter on Books is legit. Welcome, everybody. Okay. All right. This is a little bit dated, but I have to do this. Who, just raise hands. Who watched the last episode of Succession and or Ted Lasso?
That's everybody except me.
David, did you watch either?
No, I don't watch.
No, you don't have.
I've told you this. What's the last episodic TV show I watched?
The Wire.
No. The Sopranos.
That was a good one.
After that, was done with episodic television.
Okay, that's a good one to end on.
Nothing's
I watched
come
the
on
end of The Sopranos, that, too, just for the record.
We never watched, Brian and I never watched The Sopranos until the last episode. And then as we're watching it, we went, this is a really good show. And then we spent the next 10 days just watching
it. Yeah, so I'm not watching anything new until The Blacklist finishes. And then once The Blacklist is done, then I'm Ted Lasso and Succession. The Blacklist is the final season. So once it's done,
I did actually watch The Sopranos twice, a couple of years apart.
Really good.
And it was just as good the second time.
Yeah, just as good. And you would never have these shows. We never would have had The Wire. You never would have had all these other shows. Okay, yeah. Wait. Jamie, let's do Succession just quickly. Did you love or hate the last episode?
I found the whole last couple of episodes to be excruciating. And I found myself like watching it because I wanted to find out what happened in the end. And I would watch it in small doses. But I ended up not liking any of the characters and not caring who got control of Waystar Royko. I forced myself. And I have to admit, there were a couple of really good scenes, a couple of really good sibling argument scenes that were pretty engaging. But a lot of it to me was just a lot of boring posturing from people I didn't care about. So I started out. And then the other problem with the show is that while it, you know, it portrayed this internecine battle and these, you know, super rich, spoiled people, it really paled to what's actually happening in real life.
I couldn't disagree more.
So like the election episode was, you know, a pale fictional account of, you know, the craziness that actually happened during the election and the election coverage.
I think part of the brilliance of the show is that you could take the fighting of the three children, three and a half, if you count Connor, and go, you could apply that to any family, not as crazy as my family, but you could apply that to any family, different topics, different issues. And one of the things I loved about the show is they didn't play by the rules. And by that, I mean, most shows with these big ensemble casts, et cetera, they're the people you hate, but then they've got characters you like, because that's what we have to balance this out. You end up hating everyone on the show. Small characters, big characters, you hate all of them because they're horrible people.
But I have to say also that nobody in my family, and actually nobody I know, including you, talks anything like the people talked in that show. Especially the constant dropping of the F-bomb, no matter what they were saying. They couldn't
increasingly
without putting an F in the middle of it.
Increasingly, I am doing that partly because I'm just old and I don't care anymore. And partly because there has been a study recently that proved people who swear more are healthier and live longer.
Yeah, but I think creative swearing is one thing, but just the gratuitous constant use of this word that we don't really value much anymore because it's just so ubiquitous is just doesn't, I don't know. I kept thinking, I don't know these people. I don't want to know these people. I don't know anyone like these people.
Okay, Ted Lasso, the best. And the last episode of Ted Lasso, I have now watched twice. I laughed, I cried. It was better than Cats. And Ted Lasso, not unlike, in a different way, but not unlike Succession, breaks so many rules. But the last episode, Brian and I are watching it, and every 20 seconds I'm hitting him going, who thought of that? Who thought about that brilliant idea? I don't want to give anything away for people who haven't seen the last episode, but there were so many things in it. And just when earlier in the season, I thought, oh, maybe this is getting a little too sweet, then something happens. Spectacular.
They did a pretty good job of that. So there was one, and I don't want to give anything away either, but in the last episode, there was one moment where Ted gives some feedback on the book that Trent Crim is writing, which to me I saw as a big hint that the show might be back for another season without Ted.
Well, okay.
You know what I'm talking about? The comic?
Yes, I know exactly, and don't get my hopes up. Okay, let's talk about books. Best children's books.
What, on this show?
On the show. Occasionally. I got stopped today by somebody driving down the road, stops, waving. And she goes, I love Chatter on Books. It's the best thing ever. I should read more books, but I don't really read books. But I love listening to you all. It sounds like so much fun. Like, there you go. You succeeded. Okay, BBC, best children's books. I had some issues with this list, shockingly. Number one, Where the Wild Things Are. Okay. David, yes?
Fine. Yeah, good. It's a great book.
Yeah,
great book.
Lily, yes or no? Thumbs up, thumbs down.
I think it's good. I haven't read it in a while.
Yeah, no, exactly. Pippi Longstocking. Eesh. Come on. The Little Prince. Okay, be honest. Who's read it? Not me.
I read it in French class, Le Petit Prince.
Good.
By Antoine de Saint-Exupéry.
But the
story's not great, but the French is simple enough that I could follow along.
Sure. I was happy with Charlotte's Web being up there. That was good.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's good inspired book. Inspired Winnie the Pooh, the best.
Love
Winnie the Pooh. My son Charlie, for reasons not worth explaining, took Latin for 6 years. Six years. Yeah. And he and my dad, God rest his soul, because my dad studied Latin for years, used to send each other notes and cards and stuff in freaking Latin. And then there's a Latin version of Winnie the Pooh. And Charlie, God bless him, would get on the phone with my dad, whose name happened to be Charlie, and they'd be cracking each other up with Latin jokes about Winnie the Pooh.
How do you say, isn't it funny how a bear likes honey in Latin?
No clue. I'll get Charlie on the show. Okay. Fairy Tales by Hans Christian Andersen. Absolutely. Kind of brutal.
Those are all scary.
Yeah. Then The Very Hungry Caterpillar.
Oh, definitely.
Definitely.
I enjoyed that book very much. Yes.
Yeah.
And my grandkids love that book.
And Good Night Moon, of course.
We could read it to them like 10 times in a row and they read it again.
That's one of the ones of all the stuff that I've thrown out over the years. That one I kept just because it just has fond memories. Okay. I want to talk about this Michael Lewis thing very quickly. So yes. Michael Lewis of Moneyball, Blindside, incredible writer. Months and months and months ago, before Sam Bankman-Fried of crypto fame and disaster had gotten in all the trouble, somebody introduces them. Michael Lewis, who's brilliant, thinks this is kind of an interesting guy. And Sam Bankman-Fried proceeds to give Michael Lewis complete and total 24/7 access to him and to all his meetings and to all his calls and to all his personal time. Michael Lewis set up camp in the Bahamas where Sam Bankman-Fried and gang had really started to do a lot of their operations. And now, obviously, the story's gotten even more interesting. And there are already legal issues being thrown around. Can Michael Lewis be subpoenaed? All these kinds of things.
Yeah.
Sam Bankman-Fried, in it's house arrest, right? In his parents' home, in his parents' multi-million dollar home in Palo Alto. I hope he's okay. I hope he's doing okay. Continues to have the access to him. And Michael Lewis has made these jokes about, you know, yeah, as long as they let me keep coming in the front door, I'm going to keep doing this. But David, what are we to make of this? And Jamie, have you ever had that kind of access? Let's pretend the craziness hasn't happened with Sam Bankman-Fried and all the fraud. Mm-hmm. But have you ever had that kind of access to someone like that, to someone in your world?
For that long? No. No, yeah. I mean, that's, well, the guy, Tim Alberta, just wrote that story about Chris Licht in The Atlantic that was 15,000 words, and he spent a year with him.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, that was amazing. And by the way, so pretty much, and Tori, you have a background in advising people on public relations, and I would never advise anyone to open their life up entirely to a reporter. Nothing good is going to come of that. Mm-mm. And Chris Licht at CNN is now, his question is doubtful based on his the hubris that he had, that he thought he could just have a bring a reporter in and it was all going to look great.
Right.
But Michael Kelly, is that his name? Kelly?
Michael Lewis.
Yeah, Michael Lewis. I read a thing, somebody asked me, you know, like, how did you know this was going to be such a story? And he said,
and he
had no idea. He just,
and he knew nothing about cryptocurrency. He just thought this would be interesting. Yeah,
it's absolutely incredible. But he has the most, you know, all of his books,
brilliant.
Beginning, you know, with Moneyball, and he wrote a couple of others that were he just has this knack of being in the right place at the right time and getting people to open up to him. It's incredible. And so the short answer to your question is no one has ever invited me.
We've talked about this before.
Although, Tori, I was thinking I should write a profile of you, but I would have to camp out of your house for a year or so.
Well, we have no home, so you're welcome. You're welcome. Right?
Well, that's why you're homeless at the moment, right?
Yeah, unhoused. You'd be unhoused with us, but that'd be okay. Yeah.
We've talked about this before with Joe McGinnis, right? In Fatal Vision. Remember?
Yes.
And he came in and was going to exonerate Jeffrey McDonald. And halfway through the book, he goes, oh, he's guilty, isn't he?
Yes. Yes.
He really did it.
I'll tell this story very quickly, because while I would never tell anybody for whom I worked or supported to do something like Chris Licht did or crazy Sam Bankman-Fried did, as Jamie knows, I'm a huge believer, as much information as possible, as much access as possible. Decades ago, when I worked for John McCain, he was this unknown member of Congress. So we would often say to a reporter, it was like a mini version of embedding, say, spend a day with them, spend 2 days with them, right? And you will really see that there's something here, right? And other people on the staff hated me for this, because John McCain, of course, go, sure, you know, I love him. And then that meant the staff had to really bulk up his schedule. So I said, I want him out of bed at 5 o'clock in the morning. I want him going till midnight. You know, I want us on the docks at 4 o'clock in the morning, greeting workers. And they say, there are no docks in Arizona. I said, I don't care. Drove them crazy. Okay. Guess what we don't have time for, kids?
Oh, the
actual discussion of the book? Are we done already?
No, our wonderful author is here. It's 21 after. So we're going to have to go to her. Exactly. So once again, maybe we're not supposed to talk about it.
Right. The end of the lit major, right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, we'll go David, then Jamie very quickly, and then Lily, because Lily might actually know something about this, and she is a lit major. But the story in The New Yorker 3 months ago, which I've been trying to talk about ever since, is about the devastating decline of lit majors at college campuses across the country. And there are different reasons given for this, lack of funding, these kinds of things. David, what are we to make of it? And is there anything to do about it?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, I'm a, as you know, stupid advocate for college. I think it changes people's lives. I think more part of our problem is we're making it way too expensive for people to go to college. And I hate the idea that there aren't lit majors. I think lit majors are very cool in a lot of ways, you know, because they live in a world of words. I think that's awesome. I think we need people in our lives that live in a world of words. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And I'll interject before we go to Jamie. Literature majors, English majors, you know, pick your poison. They can and generally do look at so many different aspects of life and humanity. Mm-hmm. versus if you're an engineering major, you're looking at one part of the bandwidth and nothing else. Jamie?
So I'd say two things about this. One is, you know, there is this debate right now because it's graduation season and people are giving commencement addresses about whether it's wise to tell graduates that they should follow their passion literature, or whether they ought to take a cold, hard look at which professions are paying most money and, you know, how they can maximize their earnings. And so I feel this real, you know, nostalgia for the idea that you would just learn for learning's sake and then you'd figure out the rest later. And as someone who majored in journalism, when I went into journalism, I discovered many, many, many of my contemporaries did not study journalism. They studied all kinds of other things, you know, geography, you know, history, Latin, for things they had, law. People studied law that went into journalism. And I sort of favor that. And I sort of bemoan that a little bit. But I think it's part of this idea that we're in this age where people want you to just make entirely cold-hearted, practical decisions about what's going to best advantage you rather than what might just delight you.
I think, and at another show, we'll go into this much more deeply, and I think it may be a long-term effect of the pandemic. I think that pendulum, Jamie, is going to swing. But let's go to the expert, Lily Martin, yes. Chatter on Books, best intern, favorite intern.
Oh,
you are a lit major. Why are you a lit major and how do you find it?
So it's really weird for me. I went into college like wanting to be like an environmental science major because that's something I was passionate about and you make money with that. And then I let myself take an English class and like immediately everything shifted for me. Like school got better. The sun was shining more. Everything was just better. And then it just like, I was like allowed to be creative and like use my imagination, and my homework is just reading books, which is just like the coolest thing ever.
Nice.
I do think with the article, it wasn't brought up, but I feel like whenever I tell people I'm an English major, I do get like automatic respect for it in a bit because I think people know it's very challenging, and that it takes like a certain amount of creativity to do it. But on the other side, I've had people be like, what are you going to do with that? And then at my school specifically, like they sell themselves by focusing on humanities, like in all aspects, but then so much money is put into like our new science center. And then there's like nothing in English really. And I think there's only 40 English majors. So like 4% of the school.
Uh-huh.
And then one thing I find interesting, I just wrote down a few points, was that because in like all my classes, I'm focusing on like older fiction, I'm so intimidated by reading modern novels. And that's so scary to me because all of my favorite books are now from the 1800s and like written from so long ago from authors people don't know of. So like reading contemporary fiction, I'm just like, it's kind of overwhelming. But yeah, I love being an English major.
You dissed engineers there at the beginning, and I just want to make one point. My college roommate was a mechanical engineer, one of the smartest guys I know, and very, very well-rounded. He actually finished his five-year program in 4 years. Just coincidentally, I finished my four-year program in 5 years.
Balances things out.
But just because you're an engineer doesn't mean you don't love all kinds of cultural things as well.
Yeah. Well, you can. Okay. Now we're really late.
Yes.
Laura Scalzo, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be on your show, Tori.
Oh, my God. We love having you. Make sure I'm pronouncing your last name correctly. You say it.
Scalzo.
There we go. Had it right. Okay. Yeah. So this is such a great transition from Lily. And I understand you know Lily. Talk about small world.
Yes.
She finds contemporary fiction intimidating. In a wonderful way, and we'll come to it a lot, your book, American Arcadia, I found intimidating. I thought, do you guys, David and Jamie, do you remember Anne Hornaday's book about the movies? Anne Hornaday, who's the Washington Post movie critic, wrote this incredible book.
I'm just thinking, no, I don't.
About movies?
Yes.
And I read that book, and I was so intimidated by it. And I thought, oh, my God, there's so much more going on in movies than I ever thought. And I read this book, Laura, and I read it a couple of times. And I thought, there is so much going on in here. And this is so smart. And we should have a really smart person on the show, your episode, to talk about it. And then I failed. And I have Jamie and David.
Completely failed.
I'm
so sorry, Laura.
But it's fabulous. But let's talk about you first. You were one of the very few people we've had on the show, very few authors, who as a child wrote and wrote and wrote. You did this as a child, right? You loved reading. You had pen pals, craziness.
Oh, so that is interesting. I don't ever, because a lot of writers say they had journal after journal after journal. And I always thought I never did that. I never journaled. And then I realized I was a pen pal person. I still love stamps and letters and the post office. And
good for you.
So that was really a big part of it. And maybe it's what formed my writing style, because I always think, you know, I came across this idea, which is there's not a collective verb for readers. And I love that because it's never that. It's only the writer, only the reader, a one-on-one thing. So it feels like that same experience. Do you still
write letters to people?
I'm trying to start that up again. Yeah. I think I'm a avid emailer. I mean, uh-huh. I think, you know, getting a book published is, especially if you're an unknown, basically like me, is almost an impossible thing.
Sure.
And one of the things I can do is write a, interesting email. And that's one of the things that I think helped me connect with the next and the next and the next.
Yeah.
Kind of ability to communicate.
My thing these days, though, and I, like you, I've started to, my handwriting is terrible, and that's a big downfall on this, but I've started to try to write more notes to people. I was, for decades, I was a huge note writer. Thank you. That was it. You know, these kinds of things. And then it went away for decades, and now it's coming back for me. And because we're also inundated with so many different, you know, emails, texts, you know, all these different group chats, everything else. And so if I get something in the mail, it might be a postcard, it might be a letter, I'll sit there for half an hour, 45 minutes and treasure it. So I'm trying to do it. And I tried in the last years of both my parents' lives, I tried to get my kids, their grandchildren, to write them letters.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious. And this was true even after many years of private school education and college. I would send them a note, like a care package, and say, here's an envelope, here's a stamp, here's how you address an envelope, and then, you know, make it up for yourself inside, because that was so terrible. But, okay, can we talk about Syracuse, where my daughter's
sure, living? Sure.
You went there, you bleed orange. What is it about Syracuse? These are just a handful. You may know some more of these people, but I've noticed over the few years we've done this show, there are some unbelievable writers that have come out of Syracuse. So Cheryl Strayed, Stephen Crane, Joyce Carol Oates, George Saunders, we've tried to get on the show. He doesn't even respond. And Alice Siebold. Is it that you go up into the northern tundra there, which is Syracuse, and there's nothing else to do, so you can be really good at learning how to write and writing? What is it about Syracuse?
Well, I will say the writing, the creative writing program is very hard to get into. And when I was there, what's his name? What we talk about when we talk about love, you know, the famous short, Raymond Carver.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it was one of the original things that was a roadblock for me, because to get into his class, you had to have a story. And I didn't have a story to get into the class to write a story. So, but I know so many big writers come out of there, but I feel a little different. And I have to swing back to your original conversation, say I was an English major.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated in 83, and every single person, Lily, said to me, because it was very professionally oriented at that time in general, said to me, what are you going to do? And I'd always say, oh, I'm going to be a bartender. And, but the fact of the matter is everything is story. Everything, the way we understand the world as humans is story or myth. And so I worked on Wall Street for you know, basically 2 decades and 2 different jobs. And that's all story in the job that I did. I mean, I was a trader, I was a broker, but when I worked in the energy markets, we'd, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd go into work and I'd say, there's a hurricane in the Gulf. There's, you know, something happened in the Middle East. Here's what, you know, this person is doing. Here's how it looks. And every day, that's how I made my living, with story. And that is English major stuff.
Yeah. Did you ever think about journalism?
You know, I did, but I went to Syracuse and I was very, very, I didn't get into Newhouse. So, you know, so I was very, very intimidated by those kids because it's all a big deal and they all have gone on to be big journalists. So that was another thing that I didn't think was accessible to me.
Yeah.
And I recently actually did a small piece of reporting for this very cool website that just does stories about teachers. And I was so, incredibly proud. I was like, wow, I did a journalism thing. And it was something that I thought wasn't available to me.
Right. And
I also think as a fiction writer, like my way of saying the truth is through story. And that I always worried as a journalism person, as a journalist, that I the facts would get in the way of what I was trying to say, if you can imagine.
Oh yeah. No. Who's the okay, it's a famous line. I write fiction so I can tell the truth. Who said
there
that?
It is. I don't know, but that's it.
I'm thinking Tom Wolfe. Okay, wait. Jamie first, then David. What or who helped your writing the most? Not your reporting skills, your investigatory skills, all those kind of things, but who or what helped your writing the most?
So, you know, writing for broadcasting is a lot different than writing, you know, pretty much anything else, including thank you notes. But it's funny because you said you were, you know, you were intimidated by, you know, that the journalism writing would be more difficult. They'd be constrained by the facts, whereas I'm completely intimidated by fiction. You know, facts, I can just write. I just look at the facts and say, here's what the story is. And I think it was Don Graham of The Washington Post who coined the phrase that journalism is the first rough draft of history. And because of deadlines, I'm constantly writing only the first draft. I never get a chance to revise things, perfect them. But one of the most, one of my best bosses when I was at WTOP radio did this thing that no other news director that I worked for did, was at the end of the day, he would take the scripts that all the reporters had filed and he would mark them up with suggestions of better ways to say and do things, better ways to structure. And he would stick it in our mailboxes. This was back in the days before computers. And it wasn't done with any, you know, you weren't in trouble.
Yeah.
It wasn't like you can't write. It was just like, you know, instead of saying, you know, the car, police said the car was traveling at a high rate of speed. He would just say, you know, just say it was going fast.
Car went fast.
And he would cross out extra words and just have a better phrasing of things. And he did that constantly. So it was like every day I'd get a little feedback about a better way to say something.
Sure.
And it was enormously helpful.
Yeah.
But, you know, in journalism, sometimes you're under such a deadline, you end up writing things that you know shouldn't be written that way, with a long dangling participle in the front with way too many words, but you don't have time to fix it.
Yeah.
And that's where a really good editor can help. But
okay. Wait, David, hold on. Thank you, Jamie. We have a correction. Claude, who said that line? If you want to.
So according to the internet, Joshua, Albert,
the internet's not wrong.
If you want to tell the truth, write fiction.
Yeah, I like that. That's true.
And also there's a Tim O'Brien who said fiction is the lie that helps us understand the truth. Again, all from the internet. Yeah,
from the interweb. Okay, yeah. Well, we'll take
it. So Tori's version, I write fiction so I can tell the truth, is actually a better version of that quote.
Well, and we can always just attribute it to Tori Clark.
Well, because then
now it's a Tori Clark quote.
When you look up quotes, you often find who actually said it, but the person usually credited with the quote is the one who said it best.
I'll tell you, Tim O'Brien is the example. I mean, what is a better example of a fictionalized story?
Yeah.
In that book. Holy
moly. Yeah. Okay, David Aldridge, greatest influence on your writing?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's two. I don't want to take too much time because we want to get back to Laura, but
get your book.
Len Shapiro and Sandy Bailey, when I first started at the Washington Post, saved me. They just saved me. I was done. I was 22 and stupid, didn't know what I was doing. And they helped me write things that actually were plausible and made sense and were legible and readable. They were the front lines of making me better, demanding that I go back and ask more questions because you don't have it yet.
Yeah.
And make me better. And that's what hopefully every young writer has editors that good that help them.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. Okay, Laura, should we talk about your fabulous book?
Okay.
American Arcadia. Okay, there's so many ways we can get into this. And there's a classic Jamie McIntyre question, which we're going to avoid today. But let's start with this. Tell us about, and tell me if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Jaco Pastorius?
Yeah.
And why you thanked him for, quote, opening the door, end quote, in your acknowledgments.
Thank you for asking me that, because that kind of gets to the heart of the book.
Yeah.
So a real thing that happened to me was on December 21st in 1985, I was out with my roommate running around town and we met these guys at a bar.
Shocking.
And they said, we're going to go see Jaco Pastorius in a secret late night show. And we said, who's Jaco Pastorius? And they said, only the greatest bass player of all time. And we said, okay. And then something happened to her. I'm not sure what. And ultimately I went to a show at the Lone Star Cafe, which is really just a bar. It's not even a big place.
With an iguana on the roof.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Been there. Sorry.
Yes. And it was like 2-3 in the morning and I saw him play with a couple other guys. And I remember thinking something that I don't think experienced before or since, which is he is opening a portal to another world. There's something happening here that's not this world. That is something else. And the word is transcendence.
Huh?
And you know, if you Google his name, that comes up right away. Yeah. And so I always wanted to write about that experience. And so when I started this book, I started from that pinpoint and grew it out from there. And so I actually, of all the things I came across my notes from day one, just I was looking for something else for a friend. Sure. And I wrote down harmonics, transcendence, love, plot, character, humor, brain cell altering, leaping quality. I don't know what that is. State of grace. And in fact, that is the book. That is how the book rolled out. And even brain cell altering. I know, you know, they do drugs and stuff. But what I meant besides that, I meant like our minds are moving to something else, something, and it's everywhere. When you go to sleep, you dream, right? That's not the real world. That's something else. So that's what I meant.
Nice. Very, very nice. So wait, the kernel of this book, American Arcadia, has been around since 1985?
Yes.
And you've just kind of, it's been out there. Okay, now, Jamie, the Jamie McIntyre question, go ahead.
What is the book about?
I know. It's so amazing because you write a book and then people ask you that question and you think, I don't know. But so the short answer is friendship, love, sex, money, power, death. That's the practiced answer. How did I
do? In other words, life.
Life. Coming of age in New York City in 1985.
Yeah.
Transcendence. That is the main theme. And that's something, you know, there's a lot of water imagery throughout the whole book. And so that idea, so one of the characters, Cry, isn't afraid, right? She'll go in the East River. She's trying, she's seeking all of that. And she's not afraid at all. And Mina, the main character, when she discovers that's even a thing, right? She has this epiphany, like, wow, there's something besides making a living. And, but it's all very fearful to her. She can't even go to sleep, right? She can't even leave the material world.
Yeah.
All of that is fearful. All of that is like passing through that door. So that those are themes that I kind of wanted to wrap around each other.
Which you do. The wrapping around is remarkable. And it all, as you go through it, it all makes sense at the end. As somebody who spent way too much time in too many clubs in New York in the 80s,
well done.
Why 1985 New York? And is this your coming of age story?
One, because that was the exact time when I saw Jocko, and then I built it out from there. But then I had to, you know, when you sit down to write a novel, you just, for me, I just have to keep building parameters. So I decided, okay, 1 year. And then that year, and for sure, I graduated in 83. Uh-huh. And I lived with both my parents are from Staten Island. I lived with one of my grandmothers. I took the ferry for a year, and then I lived in Manhattan, et cetera, et cetera. And it was my coming of age, and I did all of it. We did, as you know, I mean, it was an amazing time. It was an amazing time.
Your first novel, The Speed of Light in Air, Water, and Glass, you called a love letter to the District of Columbia, to Washington, D.C. Is this a love letter to New York City, to Manhattan?
100%. 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see a lot of people. I know a lot of people will read this and go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And
oh, yeah. 1985.
Yeah. Good years.
It's the best year of my life. That's all I'm going to say.
Is that right?
Really?
Oh, come on. without using names, David, why was 1985 the best year of your life? Just give us characterizations of the experiences, not the people.
I fell in love with somebody who was in love with me.
Mm-hmm. Always nice.
And
always
nice. It didn't last, but it doesn't matter. It happened. It actually happened. It happened to me. And it was the first year I believed in myself. I actually believed in myself. I was 20 years old. It was the first year I actually started believing in myself because of what other people did and said to me that year when I was in college at American University. So
I'm writing this down.
Yeah. It's the best year of my life. Every year I've been trying to make up for 85 ever since.
Are you going to make a memoir about it?
You know, I could actually. It was amazing.
Oh, Laura, that's really good. We've got 90,000 different book ideas for David, all of which he rejected.
Thank you for 1985 because I remember it fondly.
That'd be a great title. Thank you, 1985.
I agree.
I was thinking just 1985.
That I was thinking that too. And by the way, 1984, it all came and went, right?
Yeah.
And 1985 is sort of like, okay, we're still standing. Now what do we do?
Yeah, right.
So Laura, there are so many pieces of this where I could go down and talk about for hours. But with almost 40 years perspective, AIDS plays a big part in this book. Yeah. What was it like you spent the last few years writing this book? What was it like having that almost 40-year perspective on AIDS in the mid-80s? Which when you go back and when reading this book, it caused me to go, oh, I wanted to go look that up. And I looked up this thing, Reagan, went, oh, my God, I cannot believe we said those things about people. I can't believe they did those things to people. But what was it like looking back on 1985 at what was going on with AIDS at the time, the crisis?
You know, thank you for asking that because I didn't set out to write about AIDS, but once I opened up the year, it had to be there.
Yeah.
And this is a little thing on the side, which is one of the things I really wanted to do in this book is articulate the interior of the World Trade Center, because we have so much visual of what's outside, but there's almost no memory. There's almost no history of the interior.
Yeah.
And so just to flash ahead, after 9/11, I was long gone from Wall Street, but I called a friend of mine to see who was alive. And so he said this, you know, he was giving me the rundown. And then I said, what about so-and-so? And he said, he wasn't in the World Trade Center, but he has AIDS. And I said to him, are you joking? And he said to me, I would never joke about that. So that's 2011. But of course, in 1985, he would have totally joked about that. And I remember thinking, right. We all don't joke about it. And to your point, Tori, have you ever seen the White House transcripts? There's King Solver, I think is
unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Right, you know what I'm talking about,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. But go ahead, share it. It's remarkable.
So I think it's 1982, somebody King Solver. Mm-hmm. Was anti-gay agenda, by the way, but he was the White House press guy from Baltimore who said, what about AIDS. 1,000 people have died. If you get it, you die. And they're all a laugh riot.
Yeah.
A laugh riot. Not just the press secretary.
You probably, Larry Speaks.
Yes. Not yeah. just Larry Speaks, but the whole press corps. And then, you know, you can pull from 19, you know, a few years later, and he's like, 20,000 people have died, and it's still a running joke, a big, oh, do you have it? Why are you so interested? He became a joke.
Yeah. Yeah. It just remarkable. And I'm so glad you have it in the story. Okay. I'm going to jump around. There are kind of two protagonists in the story. There are kind of two. Tell us about them, Cry and Mina, and with whom do you relate the most personally?
So Mina, who's the main protagonist, who's the narrator, yep. I think her story where she was trying to make a living in New York City was really my story. Uh-huh. And I was a Eurodollar broker. So those scenes, those trading floor scenes are, I would say, pretty accurate. And I was the one, I used to eat a liver or a sandwich every day, but I gave that to somebody else.
Right.
But that all her understanding, and you know, another thing that's really, really continually interesting to me, because I had to make a living, but I really wanted to be a writer and I really wanted to pursue higher things, is who gets to make art. And you know, she has this moment where she realizes her friend has the privilege and the money and the safety net to try to make art. And she is just out there grinding it out, making a living. So that part is very much me. The part that's Cry is that my great grandmother was from Pittsburgh, and we always went to Lake Chautauqua all mm-hmm. still we go. And so all of Western New York is a magical, beautiful, amazing place. And, the idea that you go up to your grandmother's house and it's perfect and nothing could go wrong. But in fact, everyone's still a human there. Yeah. And real things go wrong and families fight and all that kind of stuff. That is actually my story to say.
Yeah. Yeah. We're all Succession Jamie McIntyre. And like, final here. Okay.
I think we're all nicer than any of the people in Succession.
Okay. Ted Lasso, be a goldfish. Be a
goldfish. Exactly.
It's one of the greatest lines ever. Be a goldfish. I want to name a racehorse, be a goldfish, because I think it's such a great name. There are, Laura, in the book, in American Arcade, there are these great juxtapositions of the world of finance in the mid-80s. I mean, one of my sisters worked in it then. It's like bone-crushing, you know. It was Gordon Gekko, those kinds of things. And the desire for creativity and the better side of life and these kinds of things. When you're writing the book, was that all organic? So what do we call them, David? You know, seat of the pantsers, pantsers. Does it just happen and flow? Or did you have spreadsheets and charts and things like that?
Well, you know, pantsers are plotters, right? So yeah. The first book I wrote, Pantser, I just was like, I'm going to write a chapter today. And I built it that way. Uh-huh. And I don't want to exaggerate, but like 50 drafts easily. And this book, I just thought, I just don't want to do that. I just don't want to be like piecing it and puzzling. So I sat down on Jan 1, 2019. Uh-huh. And on April 1, I had two chapters, which isn't much. But I had an elaborate outline. I had a pictograph, a complicated pictograph of all the story threads. And everything was planned out. And I wrote from the beginning of April, I finished September, the end of September, because when you know advice, Lily, to anyone that you know, or anyone for your memoir, if you know where you're going, every writing day is so much better.
Yeah.
Much better. And weirdly, you know, there was a lot of continuity editing and copy editing, but nothing changed. I laid it down A to Z.
Yeah. Wow. You should look up in all your spare time, look up City of 1,000 Gates. Oh, and Claude helped me. I think it was Rebecca Sachs. I feel terrible. I loved her. Great author. She wrote this wonderful book about the Arab-Israeli conflict. And there were pictures of her apartment when she was writing. And it was the apartment of a mad genius. And massive numbers, David, hundreds, thousands of index cards on string with clothespin holders. And then over here, there were charts and same kind of thing. I think she started out just letting it flow. And then she sat down, said, nope, I've got to map this out. And she mapped it out to the sentence, right, David? I vaguely remember to the sentence. Yeah. And she would write it.
The Beautiful Mind was about something real, you know?
Yeah.
About, yeah. If John Nash's scribblings were about something that actually was going on, that's what she was doing.
It was wild. Okay, I'm going to stop talking now and let's do Jamie first, then David, and then Lily. You guys ask, comment, whatever you like. And then I've got one question to get us out of the so-called real part of the show. Jamie?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask Dave first.
No.
I don't have a question.
Okay.
Because you're drawing a blank. You put me on the spot and I'm
there. That's what you get for being late. David?
Laura, I think it's a great book. It's terrific. It's a terrific read. And I'm fascinated by, because when I was in college, we drank. We just drank and we kept drinking. There were some people that used drugs, but there weren't that many
in
the mid-80s. And I just wonder how different the experience was for people that drank a lot versus people that drugged a lot. You know, did they have different outcomes?
Great
did
question.
They have different experiences, to your point, outside of the kind of physical world that were meaningful or that made sense at that time?
I just want to say, I was going to ask that question, but it's in my head. So.
I think that the deal was we drank and the drugs was just to keep drinking. I'm pretty sure. And an interesting thing, I don't know, what year did Len Bias die?
1986.
And that was it. Everyone went.
That was it. That was the end of it. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone thought, oh, this could kill you. All right, then, you know, I'll just have a drink.
Yeah. How about that? Wow.
Interesting.
That's amazing. I mean, it's not amazing. I've heard a lot of people say that, but, you know, in different places. So.
But David, to your point, and this goes way down a rabbit hole. I've read something about this recently. There's a really interesting thing about drugs, psychedelics, et cetera, and creativity.
Yeah. Man, I'm not downing it. I was curious. Yeah. I'm curious if it really was different. There was a different experience. And if that showed in the writing, if that showed in the storytelling.
You know, the other thing is that, you know, we were more like wholesome, if that makes sense. But then now crack came on the scene. And so that is a whole nother incredibly dangerous, seedy, horrifying thing. It wasn't like Wall Street guys going out and, you know, it was different. Things got dangerous.
Yeah.
And deadly.
Yeah. No, good point. Okay, Lily, Lit Major. Yes. The gutters and drugs and crack cocaine. That's a smart Lit Major question.
Wait, don't tell my kids.
I won't. First, I think that the sentence structure was so similar to Their Eyes Were Watching God by Nora Hurston, which I thought was really interesting. I thought it was very similar, so I wanted to tell you that.
Thank you so much.
That's pretty cool. And that's the smartest, most high level lit thing anyone has ever said on this podcast.
Absolutely. I was going to say that if you came back to me, but Lily got there first. Okay.
And then also the seeds were really interesting. Where did you get that idea from?
Lily, I have to say that is one of my favorite things about this project because, the election came around and it started dawning on me something that I didn't think would ever dawn on me, that something that abortion rights were about to be taken away. I just didn't think that was going to occur. So I started researching in history, and the fact of the matter, legal or not legal, women have taken over their own fertility and abortion and all those issues in one way or another. And I don't know if you remember in the book, they describe how when they were burning witches at the stake, a lot of that information about seeds and plants and all that kind of things that were used as abortive fashions got lost. And so the idea that the grandmother had this sort of secret that she was using with these seeds as an abortive fashion, and that the granddaughter somehow like inheriting this legacy, which is grandmother to granddaughter by circumstance, but actually it is the way women over centuries have handed down information about their bodies and that certain kind of control of their bodies. And another thing is, I actually wrote a book that was shelved, and it was about the Kinzu Dam. Tori, are you familiar with that whole story? Because it's a Pittsburgh-related story.
No, I should be.
In any event, the U.S. government flooded the Seneca Nation to build the Kinzu Dam because Pittsburgh was flooding. And I wrote a very sort of elaborate Western New York story. And one of the characters was a native who was a botanist, a PhD mm-hmm. in botany. And so I learned all this information. And that's how I learned about the seeds. And then so that book was shelved, but I mined it for a lot of the research that I had done.
I think people would be surprised by how much research you must have done for this book. Because I think a lot of people think fiction, you know, she made it up or this or whatever. But talk about the research you did for this book. And has it given you ideas for other books?
You know, I really love to, you know, the prior book, there's basically a diary from the Secret War in Laos. Uh-huh. If you could imagine, yeah. It's a young adult book about the Secret War in Laos. No,
sure.
Shock, shock. No. No one picked it up. But anyway, I really love the idea of being able to take sort of epic stories from history and then turning it into what, you know, once again, a personal thing.
Yeah.
And so if it comes to it, if I don't know something, then I want to know it. And then I want to personalize it as intimately as possible. That's really an interesting thing to me.
Yeah. Very cool. The book's American Arcadia. It's fabulous. Really fabulous. Thank you so much for sharing it.
Hey, Chatterheads. It's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
All right, finally, what's next? What's next for you?
After, you know, the book is out, so I've got some plans for here, there, and everywhere over the summer. And then I'm going to get back to one that I started, which is a story that takes place in, I started with this concept when Prohibition passed, was October of 1919, uh-huh. but it actually didn't go into effect till January of 1920. And I had this idea of this sort of national last call. But the more you start looking into that time period, it's so incredibly interesting. So I had been doing all this research. And then I had to kind of put it aside because this one came up on the pipeline at the publisher.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to getting back to that. I really am.
Cool. I don't know why, but I love that period of time. Love it.
Yeah.
That's a promise.
Well, it's a great example of when our system of government, the Constitution, allowed a minority of the country to impose their values on a majority of the country, which is something that.
Can't imagine that ever happened.
Might ring true today.
Yeah.
Can't imagine. Could never happen again, right?
Never. Okay, Laura Scalzo, the book is American Arcadia. It is fabulous. Thank you so much. A little bit of housekeeping before we get out of here. We are back next week with Geraldine Brooks. The book is Horse. And for a long, long time, I avoided it because I didn't want people to think, oh, she's just doing this because she likes horses. But a fabulous, fabulous book. She happens to have won a Pulitzer Prize. But she'll be back. And Joe Drape is going to join us because he knows something about horses. Everyone, please go out and buy American Arcadia at your favorite local independent bookstore or on bookshop.org. Thank you to Claude, of course, for doing all the important work. David, Jamie, Lily, our spectacular best intern ever. And Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Everybody,
so
thank
much
you for listening. Stay well, and we will see you soon. And we're out.